Welcome back to RevThinking, and this season where we delve deep into the theme of transitions, those pivotal shifts that define our paths, transform our industries, and reveal our true potential. Before I dive into the details of today's podcast, if you're not already a member of Rev Community, our online community of studio founders and industry leaders, today might be the day you want to join. I say this because we're opening a new chapter for our Rev community. Members can now anticipate weekly posts featuring a handpicked selection of Stash Media's extensive archive, enriching our platform with the unparalleled inspiration and creativity from around the world. I say this because today I have the privilege of welcoming Stephen Price, the visionary founder of Stash Media. This podcast is somewhat of a momentous occasion as we celebrate this partnership between Stash and RevThink and get some visibility into what Stash Magazine has uniquely done, which curated and showcases innovative work of studios, directors, and artists globally. Stephen isn't only the extraordinary curator of the creative works from around the world, he also stands as a knowledgeable observer of the industry's evolution. Stephen's unique vantage point offers invaluable insights into the transitions that have shaped the creative landscape, from the pivotal pivots of the enduring studios to those who have faded out over the years, and of course, the emerging groundbreaking newcomers. His observations are a testament to the nature of creativity and the industry's continuous transformation. I hope in delving into the genesis of Stephen's own story and partnership with our industry that you hear the potential to fuel creativity and collaborate within our industry at large and as well as in community. It's been years since the Promax days.
It has been a while. I did a bunch of those talks. I just did it the first year. And then it went really, really well. They got really good feedback and they just kept inviting me back, which was great. It's great for your ego.
Yeah, right.
It also really helps focus, you know, you on your craft, or if you want to call it that. Because once a year, you really, really have to think about what you're doing, right? Rather than just doing it. And it's really easy if you're in media, especially, and you're posting every day, literally every day. You just get into ruts and you get into patterns that may not be optimal or, you know, the best for your viewers. So once a year, it was a very intense process of just deconstructing what you do, thinking about some larger themes. And what did you actually have anything to say? You know, did you have anything of value to actually say other than every day going, oh, here's cool work. Oh, here's cool work. Here's some more cool work. Hey, look at this cool work. I really found that helpful. And I took it very seriously. For 2 months, I would be healthy and practicing. And that's why when I got there, you know, I didn't need cue cards. I didn't need the prompter. I didn't need anything. I was just, it was so, I could have done it backwards, phonetically backwards.
Yeah. I remember your presence, stage presence was very comfortable. You definitely had a charisma and comfort for that, yeah.
Thank you. That came out of just being confident of what you were presenting and knowing that the lights could go off in the room and it wouldn't matter. I could just keep talking. The last thing you want to do is bore the audience or disappoint the audience. And that we take that very seriously here. You know, just from literally every post of every day, we try not to have any filler, right? And if some days there isn't a post, it really means that there was nothing to post. Mm. And it's, you know, it's not a typical media thing. We're not selling advertising, so we don't have to make crazy numbers. We're selling subscriptions, right? And so the thing that seems to work the best for us on that is authenticity. You know, you're building an archive that stands or falls on the quality of the work in the archive.
Yeah.
So there's no way around it. You just have to be really selective and really hardcore in what you believe stands the test of time.
So what's that process like internally? Do you have a review of concepts and ideas? Are people assigned different principles that they are always on top of and investigating so they know what their segment is or what their job is that they're going after?
You're talking about curating the work?
Yeah. You're talking about staying as relevant. So I was like, what's the internal process to stay relevant there for? And how do you know you're relevant, I guess, would be the bigger challenge.
Right. A lot of that just has to do with your gut and that being in the industry for a long, long, long time. And having been in production myself for 12 or 15 years before I got into this side of it. So I have a really good idea most of the time of what went into a project, and not just technically or creative, but because I started on the creative side and ended up on the EP side, I have a good idea of, you know, what the client relationship was and what the hierarchy was with the studio, the agency, the client, etc., and how complicated that might have been to put through. So I can see the project from a lot of different sides, but I don't think that's really your question. What we do to stay on top of work is we track about 650 studios and individuals every day for new work and for new, just news in general, like the new hires, et cetera. That combined with that, I mean, that's the core of it. That's the secret sauce. That's what we believe nobody else does. And that gives us a big advantage in terms of the number of things we have to choose from to curate, right?
Yeah.
The other side is, of course, we've been doing it a long time and a lot of people send us a lot of stuff. So we have hundreds of submissions a month. I'm very thankful for that. Obviously, we can't run them all, but that is the value. We're watching literally thousands and thousands of clips a month so that you don't have to, is the theory, right? We'll do that for you and we'll try and steer the better stuff to the screen.
So you guys are literally curators of,
correct,
of the industry, watching other people and then streaming those to your readers. And then your readers are, who are your typical subscribers that are consuming this, that are appreciating that the curation that you've done?
Sure. It's very, very wide. There's globally, it's, 70, 80, 90 countries. It's hard to keep track. Mostly it's from the US, Canada, the UK, China, France.
And they're agency people or production company owners or?
Yeah. So that's the geography. In terms of how it breaks down in terms of organizations, there's a lot of schools are subscribers, agencies, brands, studios, freelancers, basically every genre or division of labor is represented in some way. There's, you know, three different subscription models. There's individual for a year, there's a corporate for a year, and there's monthly, which is, you know, $9.99 a month. So between those three, people can generally find what they're looking for. So for instance, a school can get unlimited views for all their students for $249 a year, right? We're constantly told that that's way too cheap, but it's about making it relevant, especially on the school side. Because the more students you have loving Stash during their school years, the more people you have subscribing when they get out into the professional world and then either subscribe themselves or hound the owners of the studios they work for to subscribe, please.
Even beyond that, I want to say what you've become to the industry is a trusted source of information that is still very relevant and plugs people into something they might not yet know about. So the thought process of me, you know, trying to search the internet or track down 600 agencies or whatever that might be to see where the trends are going or the latest work. Mm-hmm. I find what Stash does is doing that work for me is one, but the place that you are in the industry, even starting from the school, from a student readers and the schools taking onto it to what our agency owners and also consuming it, is the responsibility that you've decided to take on to recognize, hold hardly what's going on in the industry and report that out to others. So that curation and purpose that you have behind there is to lift up other people and lift up the industry by pointing at them. I find some people want to grab all that information and suck that into themselves and try to own it. And you guys kind of turn that model inside out and say, no, it's about you. It's for you, about you, and with you that we're doing this work. And I love that purpose that Stash has.
Well, thank you. So do we. It's it's a labor of love. It pays the bills, but you know, certainly nobody's getting rich, right? Now, I did an interview not very long ago where they asked me, It was for the Apica Awards, which is judged by journalists. And they asked, what kind of advice would you give young people looking to get into journalism? And I just thought, well, you better farking love what you cover, because you can make more money doing anything else, right? And it was the first time I'd actually ever thought about that. But you have to truly love it. You can't be a dilettante. You can't be going through the motions, because you will die. You will die if you don't love it. If you don't get excited when you see a new piece of work come in and can't wait to get it posted, then it's probably time to move on.
Yeah, I actually read the Apica Awards interview with you, and the quote is, you said, you absolutely need to love what you cover because you can make more money doing just about anything else.
Right.
But what I appreciate about that is the emphasis on you need to love this. And, you know, from my point of view, similar to you, I went through the production rankings. I was at Imaginary Forces and ended up at Trailer Park. And these companies were growing. So I had an opportunity to, we'll say, serve the industry very differently than just working at production companies, but work alongside my friends who were running companies and help them build systems, routines, operations, financial things, that thing for them, that obviously becomes known as a consultant. But when talking to people about what I do, I say, you don't understand. I love my job so much. I love the people that I serve. I love the messages that are out there. I love the needs and the requirements and the hard work it takes to get these companies up and successful and running. It's just so exciting. And to be part of that kind of movement within an industry. And I feel like, and again, like just going back to the days that you and I had met at Promax, I remember just clicking with you and recognizing, oh, wait, we have something in common. We're serving this group of people that are here at this conference. And I can see that in the work that you're doing, and even just the longevity of Stash, that you're keeping it going and you're keeping it relevant. It's hard work to keep it relevant.
I mean, I was trained as a graphic designer and then moved into computer graphics, computer animation. And these are my people, right? These are the people I'm most comfortable with on the planet. And this gives me a way to stay really involved with that world without having to do production. Because you've been there. Production is a grind. And it's very rewarding when you're there and you're young and you're doing it. But after a while, I just felt like either I need to be the client or I need to do something else, right? Yeah. And this gives me, fortunately, you know, through, if you read that Apica thing, you know, I was asked by a friend to write some stuff for their magazine, just freelance. And that is what started the whole slide into this. So I was very lucky to have this outlet. Otherwise, I don't think I could still be doing production. Mm. I mean, I got a chance to do all sorts of it and it was fabulous. But, you know, that part of it came to an end.
Well, actually, that's why I wanted you to be part of this season of my podcast. This season, I'm focusing on transitions. And I find the most interesting transitions are the ones where people go beyond just the work product, let's say. So not go beyond being the producer or creative person delivering the good to the client, which is a season of our career. I call that the either the artist stage or the auteur stage, if other people are doing it and you're the business owner. But eventually we evolve or need to evolve into what I call the curator stage. And that curator stage is when you are lifting up others while lifting up yourself. And I think when your pivot, because I've read your story and I've obviously talked to you years ago, but the story of how Stash got started and then your responsibility in that was this thought process of, wait, there are gifted and talented, amazing studios all over the place. And then your personal desire, or as you said in the article, love for them and that work, makes you want to go do something else and promote that work. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what it was like in that transition? I know it's been a few years ago now, but do you remember what it was like? Were you afraid? Was there some doubt? Was there curiosity? What was it like?
Yeah, it was bad. Before I came up with the idea for Stash, it was Well, not to go down this whole rabbit hole, but I...
Go down it. We can edit.
Okay. So before I left Toronto, I was working for Core Digital, which was doing TV series and feature films. And I was selling that little visual effects company into LA from Toronto. And I was going up against all these companies that I had grown up, you know, idolizing, like ILM and Rhythm and Hues, et cetera, et cetera. And now I was on the bid list with those guys. And so that was the peak of that. And while I was there, I pitched three television shows to one of our clients. And that one of them that he really liked was a television show called Splat. And it was about animation. It was a magazine show about animation. And he said, I could sell this. And so I quit Core and rejoined with a previous business partner. And that was the original thing that got me out of that production. But now I was in television production.
Totally different game, isn't it? Television production is not the same.
I got more ambitious and I licensed a children's book and was going to do a Saturday morning series. And when that collapsed for the second time, when that deal fell apart for the second time, I put down the phone and I picked the phone back up and I phoned this musician friend of mine who had just moved to LA. And I said, give me the number of that immigration lawyer. I'm coming with you. And it was like this snap decision. So I moved to LA and believe it or not, I wrote screenplays for 3 years, 2 years. And I wrote three of them and optioned two of them. And it was, you know, it was a modicum of success. And then that freelance writing thing came around and that sort of started turning on all these lights. Because you remember Shots was around then and they were out before us and they were doing DVDs. And when I was writing for boards, it was really, really apparent that the animation design visual effects side was second class citizens. Like they weren't even apologetic about it. It was all about live action directors were the stars. And from my point of view, I just thought it was the design animators and visual effects artists who should get that same treatment, right? At least that same treatment. So I pitched this as, I found some partners. One of them was, I had a background in the publishing industry and magazines, and the other one had money. So the three of us made a pretty good team, and I pitched it as the Shots of animation, visual effects, and motion design. I designed a prototype, like a working prototype. It's just a physical prototype with the booklet and the disc. And my partner and I flew to LA, and we went around to about 20 different studios, tiny ones up to Digital Domain, and walked around and said, you know, would you subscribe to this? Would you like to be involved with this? Do you think this would be useful in the industry? And glowing reviews out of the 20 places, like 19 of them were glowing and one was meh. So we said, all right, let's just do this. So we did. And we took the first batch to the next SIGGRAPH. It'd be 20 years this fall. In LA, we just took them to SIGGRAPH, like in bags, and handed them out to people.
That's so awesome.
That is not a business plan.
No, that is passion at play. That is
exactly right.
One, you have a very strong conviction, which I can share with you. The industry that I'm part of, more often than not, the post animation design, right, motion graphic field, I, you know, was not even on my radar as a career or a job or a place. It was great to, you know, to be at RGA Los Angeles that became Imaginary Forces and to be part of the seven title sequence was something that, you know, elevated all of our careers and pulled us into something that I think later became a very strong industry. In the moment, it's just something that you did out of passion. So for you to recognize that and want to explain that, and then again, without a business plan, but just handing out the information to see if other people love it. I do like that you went door to door. There's a part of that real world interchange that you had with these business owners or executives or whatever that might be, because I know some of those businesses were much larger. Do you remember any of them at that moment questioning or trying to understand, or were they mostly passionate and full behind you?
I remember Digital Domain staring at it and just flipping through the book and going, this is awesome. It wasn't all that glowing all the time. Some people were, you could tell they're just being polite. They had never seen anything like it, so they were being polite. But overall, we could tell that the pendulum was swinging in our direction. Like, this was something that the industry could really use. And we did that for 6 years. We did DVDs for 6 years until 2010, we switched everything to online. And then in 2022, we redid that online, the subscription product, the permanent collection. We rebuilt it into a Netflix type UI. And then we lowered the prices to be more in line with those types of services. So, and, you know, $99 a year, $9.99 a month. And that really gave us like a renaissance. Like it's hard to explain how much better business is now.
Sure. Well, I guess another thing I'm curious about, because you've been now covering the industry for so many years, do you remember what those first articles were about? Who were the first articles about, and what did you cover in your first few editions?
It's never been topic based, right? And this is something that PR people still have trouble with, is they ask us, you know, send us your editorial calendar. We don't have an editorial calendar. Editorial calendars are built for advertisers, right? So you know what advertisers to pitch. We have never done that. It's always been work related. So the best 30 or so pieces, 31 pieces every month or every issue, those are what get published. So it's completely organic and like comes out of the work, right? And it always has. So I actually really like that, because it's always a surprise and it's always interesting.
Sure.
Right? Not going, all right, so March, we need a 2D character. Where are we going to find the 2D character stuff? Right?
Yeah, right.
You're free to find the very coolest work that you can find. Now, with each issue, you want to strike a balance. You want to have TV spots. You want to have broadcast design. You want to have music videos, short films, brand films, explainers. You need a balance, right? But that balance doesn't have to be strict. We don't have five slots where we need music videos, right? Music videos may balloon up to seven in one and go down to one in another, because you're curating what's happening in the industry. You're not trying to control that. You're just tempering the flow or finding the very best bits of that.
So again, like, you know, when you first started covering 20 years ago, do you remember some of the topics or people you covered 20 years ago?
Absolutely. There was some people have come and gone, like Digital Domain. I keep mentioning them. I don't know why. They were a big deal in those days.
They were a very big deal in that day. That's post-Titanic, the whole James Cameron time and Michael Bay movement. Yeah.
On the commercial side, because we don't cover the body of effects from television series or feature films, but we do cover the title sequences.
Mm-hmm.
They did a lot of commercials in those days. There's a lot of studios that are not around anymore. Probably the two that have stayed relevant that I can really think of, maybe three, four, I'm counting now, making this up. I would say Buck, PsyOp, Nexus, Studio AKA, and I'm going to forget somebody and they're going to kill me.
But 20 years ago, Stephen, 20 years ago, Buck was a little house, I want to say out of Venice Beach or something like that. Those guys were...
And PsyOp were four people in an abandoned bar in the Lower East.
So when you were 20 years ago, were you recovering? I'm guessing you were covering Rhythm and Hues and Digital Domain and ILM and on their commercials, on the commercial side. There was a big stuff there, and the Bucks and the PsyOps came out of this movement from when you got started to who they are now. You've watched them evolve over 20 years. So the people are relevant today. That's what you've seen. The progression of and firsthand with their work product.
I just remembered the one I forgot, Imaginary Forces.
Oh yeah, I know them well. They were, well, yeah, that's, but we're 20 years ago, so that'd be 2004. You know, that's already, they were known for the title. I'd already left in 2000, so we'd already been 7 years old by that time.
They were the very peak of the industry, and they still are. They yeah. really still are. They keep reinventing themselves. They have new talent that keeps refreshing everything. And in the pecking order for the stuff that they do, there's probably them and Elastic who compete for the very best title sequences on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to respect that. And if PSYOP and Buck, you have to respect that longevity. It's unimaginable to me to be able to keep that level of creativity going, because I've never been involved with a company that was managed to do it. You know, people just lose their passion. People, you coach all sorts of businesses. You know the pitfalls of it. They lose their passion. They lose their way in terms of creativity. They lose their way in terms of managing people and creating an environment that people want to be in. Or they lose their way financially. You know, they get carried away in empire building. They get carried away in ego. They get carried away in like their own personal lifestyle, trying to pay themselves more than the company. I mean, now you're smiling there, because so I know you identify with that.
Yeah, you're.
It's a really complicated, so many balls in the air task that to keep that going for so long, we should, you know what we should do? Write this down. We have to do a Hall of Fame. We need to do a motion design Hall of Fame, and we'll have an inaugural class of like the people we just talked about. And then every year we'll have some sort of ceremony at a bar, and we'll just, and we'll put in, we'll add 3 or 4 people or, studios per year. They don't still have to be around. They could still be around.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
I love that one. Could we get, yeah, there's achievements to be captured, isn't there, year over year. What you're processing, I process often, because I think of, so imaginary forces, right? There are some people there that were there in the beginning with us. Karen Fong, Grant Lau, obviously Chip and Peter, Chip Houghton and Peter Frankfurt, obviously the founders of it. But even like Linda Nakagawa is like the finance person. She's been there, big part of her career is just at that place. So there are stable parts of companies like that. Buck, same way, same founders, same strength. And then there's that dynamic ability to shift in and out. And when I, being the consultant that I am, and I love the idea of transitions, there's a thought of like, how do you stay relevant? What is important? And how do you honestly curate, right? Going back to that word again, the talent, the creative person, and the needs within the industry to stay relevant. The reason why I'm dedicating this season to transitions is I feel like the industry is once again going through a large transition, not unlike what it felt like late 90s, early 2000s, imaginary forces, when optical were how you did motion design. You did it on film, in front of a lens, and you animated it by hand. And that's why 7 was so gritty and real. It was actually done on film, 26 miles of film to create those title sequences, to what we can do now digitally, but then this new evolution that's taking place. So there is something, a lesson to be learned from you here, which is, you know, staying relevant as well as keeping up on trends is something that many people are asking and really want to make your quote unquote Hall of Fame, right? That's what would make the Hall of Fame, is people that knew and could achieve that kind of success.
Yep. I just have immense respect for people that can balance that many balls, like curate that many things at once for so long, and not just fall into some paying the bills type of factory. Right. Mm-hmm. But people that are still defining trends, people that young directors and young graduates still really want to work for, right? That is like not recognized, especially in our industry, which is, you know, of a certain size and a certain place in the world. It just doesn't get the recognition from the outside. Actually, speaking of that, these the new Collision Awards are the first ones that I've ever known to take such a broad grasp of categories. I mean, Motionographer Awards are great, but these look much, much broader. And more importantly, they bring gravity and scale, right, to the awards. And that's super important, because one of my pet peeves in terms of this recognition we're talking about is that awards, there's so many advertising awards, right? I mean, nobody can count them all. They're literally infinite. And without fail, they group what we do into three categories max, right? And often those categories are mislabeled and misdiagnosed. They're not even described properly, right? No. This is what I mean about the second class citizen thing about motion design and animation. Anyway, we helped Collision design these awards so that they could avoid that pitfall. I think it's a real landmark this year that those guys are going to launch and actually give motion design and animation real recognition from the ground up, like doing the research and finding out what kind of categories and what the breakdown, the genres of work are in our industry, like really being concerned about that. So that really endeared me to them and made us want to help them. And that should help, right? That will help. But still, the way that the advertising industry, oh, here's another one. Here's another pet peeve of mine. Somebody puts out like a huge commercial full of animation or full of visual effects usually, and you go, you read about it, and there are no parking credits for the animation company.
Yeah.
Or the visual effects company. All there is credits for the agency. Okay.
Agency and director maybe. And sometimes editorial.
And then don't get me wrong. Obviously the job started with them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I'm not saying they shouldn't be credited, but the job wouldn't be what it was without the rest of the supporting cast. Right. That's why we're like pretty adamant about crediting everybody and their mother whenever we post stuff.
No, you're good. I'm with you. I share a lot of the same passion for telling the whole story and knowing the workload that's necessary. You know, in many cases, when we jump into our career, we silo ourselves too soon. And some of that's just trying to provide or discover, or you're finding your gift and the best application for it. But could I have been a visual effects producer? I did it temporarily. Or could I have stayed in live television? Because I originally was on the Oscars and Emmys and so on. Or sometimes I wonder, should I have just gone to the Bay Area? And you know, when MSN was looking for people or CNN was looking for the original online crew, there was a lot of calling of us and trying to scoop in producers and whatever to be part of these movements. And you like, of course, I was capable of doing multiple things. But when we make a career choice, we end up staying in a silo. And then I think we have a desire to want that to be heard. So I appreciate that what Stash does and what you do specifically is recognize like there are people that whose voices aren't quite known and they deserve the credit. Just because they didn't choose live action director doesn't mean that their effort and time and their vision isn't on the screen. A lot of times the post animators and designers are keyboarding or keyframing those concepts in their boards and creating some of that vision with the agency and live action director. So there's a lot of players necessary.
Well, and more, I mean, even when I was working in the early days, you know, people would send boards over and they were literally stick figure boards, right? 8.5x11 page with like 8 frames on it and stick figures. And that, I mean, that was fine with us because we got to, you know, play with it and develop it. But to not acknowledge the people that picked up the stick figures and made it into an actual spot just seems rude to me.
Rude. I can hear it. Hey, you know, you've recognized this trend of people that have been able to stay relevant over the years or even grown up from, you know, from the time you started Stash to are very relevant now. Can you think of any attributes of those companies or leaders that will have some resilience to future transitions and changes? More of like, can you think of the attribute itself that if I was a business owner today, I would want to develop those attributes so I do have resistance?
The answer fits very well with your theme for the season. And it has to do with transitions and not fighting the transitions, but actually being on top of them, working with them, embracing them, I guess. So you could, there's a bunch of examples. So with PSYOP, for instance, starting Blacklist, right? First of all, they took on directors other than the principals. So there was the principals didn't have an ego problem with, well, we're the creatives. Why are we bringing on other directors? And then they realized that they could bring on more than that. They could bring on young directors, right? That wouldn't actually be part of PSYOP, but you would have, they'd be part of a thing called Blacklist. And you, but you, clients would have the confidence that PSYOP was standing behind it all, right? And from that model, I'm not going to bet my life that they were the first ones to do that in our industry. But since then, a lot of the English companies started doing the same thing, right? And so that's just one tiny example.
Wasn't Tomato that early on in the late 90s? Do you remember them?
That was a little bit before my tenure.
What you're saying is really a great point, because even in the example of Imaginary Forces, where you have Karen Fong and Grant Lau, who've been there almost from the beginning, there are some new directors on their roster now that are Anthony Gibbs, Alan Williams, Ronnie Koff. You know, they're more recent, and they're staying very relevant because they're finding really themselves in a talent acquisition place, and the talent benefits from being part of their roster, as well as they benefit from having relevant talent.
Right. So another example is with people like Nexus, Passion Pictures, Studio AKA. You know, they've all, I can't tell you which ones, but they've all won BAFTAs. They've won Academy Awards because they've branched out from just doing animation, where they started with, you know, title sequences and commercials. They started doing documentaries. They started doing feature films. They started doing short films specifically for the festival circuit. And then you can look at it from the whole talent management side. So what are the new positions that we need to cultivate? What tools do we need to cultivate? So for instance, I think one of the most important things that's happening on the technical side before we get to AI is the rise of 3D animation and pure 3D animation, what we like to call 3D style, which is that sort of magic realism of ultra high shiny, you know, things that it's just grabbed people's imagination like nothing else that I've seen in this industry. I can post something on Instagram, / Instagram, that is what we're talking about, that 3D style, Houdini, cinema, 4D, man versus machine, tendril, future deluxe kind of thing. And it will blow up. I can't post anything that's not that now, right?
Oh, really? Yeah. It's just a flavor of the season, I guess, right?
It's visceral for people. They just love it, right? And after my graphic design days, I started into hardcore 3D, and 3D has always been my love. So this for me is like the best of all possible worlds, because the thing that I truly love is now super popular, even with the public, right? That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Anyway, I was just gonna say on the transition side to recognize that even if you came from a 2D background or you came from a graphic design background and your company starts to grow and get better, where do you need to go? And in the last little while, that's been in 3D, right? You need to either have the 3D people in-house or at least a director in-house, and then build like a really, really solid bank of freelancers that are Houdini people, you know, Cinema 4D, Redshift people, and just hit this as hard as you can while it's happening. And it will fade a bit, and 2D illustrative stuff will come back, just like, you know, collars getting wider and narrower and ties getting narrower and wider and hems going up and down. It's just, that's what happens. So to be able to adapt on that side, adapt on what talent we're cultivating side, adapt on the client side, right? When things started to go from all agency all the time to a mix of direct to client and agency, right? Or when people started to cannibalize their own clients. So you bring stuff in-house that you used to be only your clients, and that could be, it could be post, it could be live action, like when the Mill started representing their own live action directors with Mill Plus. Well, in some states of mind, that is like, what are you talking about? Our clients are going to freak out, right?
Right.
But guess what? Everybody adapts.
Because their clients were the directors.
A lot of their clients were coming from production houses, right? But yeah. There's a lot of other clients who are not production houses, and they would like to have everything under one roof.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm sure the entrepreneur feels like they're just guessing. Or when they succeed, it's interesting to talk about how the language they often use is they, quote unquote, they just knew it was the right thing to do, which to me sounds like you guessed, then you got it right.
Yeah. Right?
And instead of recognizing the opportunity is the transition and to stay relevant, to stay up on something. So, you know, for some houses, to be in the moment, to do Houdini and be in the moment is great. For others, it's to recognize the future will come and this is your moment to invest in something or understand something that no one else is touching. And the AI situation we have right now, I liken it to back in the, I call it like a platform war of what was Silicon Graphic machines and these big, large $250,000 machines that you had to buy to do computer graphics to a desktop computer at a discount rate of $15,000 to $20,000 a computer. Now, you know, it wasn't until 2006 that it was $2,500 to be able to do that same render power. And now, you know, that render process has just totally changed the industry. The AI process to me is going to be something that's going to, again, people are develop skills and there's going to be a new flat earth moment that people can grow up from. And when we flatten out everyone's capabilities to this process, we'll find a different form of talent.
I think that's a good one. That was definitely a quantum shift or a seismic shift. But I think a better example would be if you can get talent into that equation. So for instance, on hardware, using your hardware example, if you go back to desktop publishing, typesetters were, they weren't mad, they were incredulous. They were incredulous that normal people could set their own type. Right? They were like, you've got to be kidding me. Oh, yeah, you just go ahead. You just go right ahead.
Yeah.
My 20 years of experience mean nothing. And guess what? A lot of that type coming out of those early Macs was garbage, right? It was garbage. Oh, look, we can stretch it. We can shrink it, right? It was garbage. But everybody gets used to that. Everybody gets better at it. And guess what? Those typographers were gone in 3 years.
Mm.
Gone. I mean, sitting down at a big compositing machine and setting type. Now, the smarter ones, what did they do? They went and bought Macs and they started their own companies. Or they went and became type consultants if they didn't actually want to sit at a Mac, right? But they adapted.
That's a really good one. Because then eventually that type gets into motion. And so the idea of doing optical effects or kind of create effects there when you have...
That's the next one. It's moving from optical to digital. And I remember when I was my first EP job out trying to sell architecture firms, when I was trying to broaden beyond commercials and music videos, I said, well, you know, architects could use this. And so I'm pitching architect firms. And there was one guy who said to me, yeah, but you know what? You see, you look out the window there. You see that building? You see the glass? Okay, that glass is not perfect. You see there's ripples in the glass? Computers will never be able to do that.
Yeah, right.
Computers are too perfect, right? So, you know, I was like 24, 25, 26 years old. I was like, computers can do anything, man. We can do anything. You want variation in your glass? I'll have that done for you this afternoon, right? And I think to keep that sort of youthful, anything is possible attitude is really what keeps at some level, not that naive, you know, jumping up and down, waving your hands level, but a more mature level of that enthusiasm is what keeps the Nexus and the Bucks and the imaginary forces staying relevant. Now, so back to AI, I think, you know, we can come up with all the models we want, but I don't think that there's anything really to compare with this in terms of scale and in terms of speed, right? Because the shift from optical to digital took a while. The shift from real typesetters, old school typesetters, to desktop publishing took a while. this is literally taking months, right?
Yeah. It's not even, it hasn't even been a year yet.
That rightfully scares people.
Oh, no, I was going to say, like, you're correct. It hasn't even been a year yet. And the disruption or the sense of disruption is already implementing itself and planting itself into our industry.
Right. And I think even in the last week, I mean, I see stuff happening daily now that is bearing out my own feeling that people are just going to adapt, right? It's not going to make anything go away. All the best people are just going to adapt. So big production houses, they're going to have directors who specialize in AI. There's going to be studios who specialize in AI. And Buck and all the other studios that we're talking about, a certain number of them will all have people that specialize in AI, right? It's just going to be another thing that gets worked into the workflow. It's just going to be another tool. I see it happening. We published stuff this week where people are telling, you're walking through, okay, we combine 2D effects and 3D characters and live action, and we use some AI to generate backgrounds here, here, and here. There was one we just published this week, a couple days ago, where somebody used AI to generate collage. It's like old school cutout collage-y type of thing, which is minorly cool right now. Right? It's not a super popular technique, but if it's done right, it's still cool. And these guys generated all sorts of imagery and worked it right into the collage. It still looks like it's supposed to be like the late 1800s. It still looks like that, but a lot of the imagery is generated with AI, right?
Genius, yeah.
The spot wasn't generated with AI, but elements of it were. It doesn't mean that spots can't be generated or won't be. They certainly will be. But what we're seeing now is the integration of it, this slow, meaning in the course of weeks, we're seeing it being integrated into productions. So it's not going to be like a oh, I had a job yesterday and now there's AI and I don't have a job.
We have an online community called Rev Community, and I asked the business owners, there's 600 business owners in this platform. And I asked the question of, you know, what level are you using AI in your current work product? And 80% said they've pitched and used AI currently in work product.
How long ago was that?
This is a week ago, 4 days ago, actually. And so that would be, you know, at this point, we're recording this on February 23rd, 2024. And there was the next 20% that are not currently using it, at least 10% more said they're using it for internal purposes. And only 10% said that they're avoiding it. So that, just to know, like, the adoption rate of this is actually at an 80%, 90% mark easily. And as you're saying, like, we have to mark the date and time almost, because tomorrow another revelation is going to take place within this field.
Yeah.
So much so that somebody posted the Hollywood Reporter article in the community as well, talking about Tyler Perry canceling the development of his studio in Atlanta, or studio growth in Atlanta. Apparently he was going to develop another $800 million worth of studio around his current space. And he's putting that on pause or canceling it because of the disruption of AI. And just saying, this changes everything. There's the practical, a studio space that he was going to build, he feels like it's not going to be relevant anymore.
Right.
So that's a major shift, that a major disruption. And as you pointed out, this is months old. So we're living out a very, very acute transition, isn't it? Opposed to the Typeform, the people that did Typeform, they had an acute problem, or the people that were doing opticals, that felt acute to them. But for this is industry-wide, doesn't matter if it's editorial, directing, post-production, graphic design, anything stylistically, or just simply art directing and creative directing, kind of a universal language is changing of how we're going to conceive of this new work product.
Right. I just glanced at my notes here. I saw another one that I think is relevant and can help put things in perspective. It's when Photoshop first started to make inroads in the photography world. And people were talking about, well, I don't know if it's real anymore. I don't know what's a real photograph anymore. And there were photographers at the time who prided themselves, that's not Photoshop. I would never use Photoshop. That's crazy. Wouldn't say cheating, but they would say, they just really look down their noses at it. And within, I don't know how many years, there was not a photographer on the planet who, if they didn't learn the software themselves, they certainly had assistants who knew how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the scale of that is not the scale that we're talking now, and the time frame is not the same, but it does give you a metaphor, it does give you an analog to try and understand what might happen. Because we don't know. We just don't know what's going to happen.
So I'm going to actually put you on the spot here. Because if you look back when you started Stash, the things you were covering, the ILM digital domain presence, was this thought process of a computer-generated image. Just the thought of a computer-generated image being so fantastic that it was worth covering because, man, it was amazing what computers can do. To where we are today, we'll call this the center point, that not only are the computers generating images, but at a totally different pace and a very different mindset. Put yourself forward now. I'm only going to make you guess 10 years into the future. What do you think Stash is going to be talking about?
That's a good question. We're not, the parameters that we're going to choose things with will not change. The triangle, you know, is the creative up to scratch? Is the technical up to scratch? And is the emotional quotient up to scratch? Because just if something is a good idea, something is executed well, doesn't mean it's going to make it into Stash. And I don't mean to say that in a highfalutin way. It's just that we need that emotional quotient, right? That's why a lot we don't cover the visual effects from inside a movie or a television show. Not that they're not emotional in the context of the show, but you can't lift that out of it and go, other than, wow, that crowd of soldiers from the 1500s looks amazing. Okay? That's not visceral. That's not, doesn't give you the emotion and the feeling that you need to connect the dots between stimulus and action. In 10 years, I'm not going to be doing this in 10 years, but the people that might be doing it, we would do the same thing. So it wouldn't matter if a commercial or a title sequence was generated all with AI, right? Does it work? Did it make me want to watch that TV show? Did it make me go, holy fark, I wish I had done that? If it's a product film, does it create envy? Mm-hmm. Does it make me covet that object, right? These are the emotions and the feelings that you have to generate. If it's an environmental thing, does it put a lump in my throat?
Okay, so let me ask you this question then, because
did I answer any at all?
That was great, because I heard two things actually that I want to follow up on. I'm trying to figure out which one do I put first. This thing you just said about that, if a work product, if a commercial in the future is made completely from AI, that Stash, you know, Stash will be covering it because it had those three attributes. How do we have that conversation then about the artist and what the artist's job's going to be? Because I can hear, I don't want people to hear what you're not saying, which is there isn't an artist's hand at play just because a computer is generating that graphic. It sounds like you understand that there's going to be a creative person that will know it's right and will know those three criterias that you put out there. Well, the three criterias being creative, technical, and emotional attachment. That's what you're still going to judge it on. You're going to say, hey, there's going to be an artist guiding the hand of that AI,
right?
Artist choosing if that AI effect is meeting that criteria.
It's actually a good question, because if it is AI and it's totally synthetic, it would still qualify for Stash, because we don't cover just live action stuff, right? There's lots of places that do that and cover advertising in general. We're motion design, animation, visual effects, and the effect that can have, right? We don't cover software releases and that kind of stuff. It's all about the effect that it has. Mm-hmm. So a purely AI generated thing would qualify because it's synthetic, right? It's not live action. But you've just made me think of this point, is like, where along the line would we not cover an AI project, even if it was super funny and you loved it? Because there's great live action stuff that we don't cover. I wish we could, right? Because it's just brilliant. It's just super funny and it's a great idea, but there's no animation, there's no design in it. So we don't. So where along the line, how far up the chain does AI have to go before we would not cover it? This is an excellent question. I'm going to just make this up. So if we're assuming there's going to be humans involved at some point to write the prompts, right? And to listen to the client and say, well, yeah, I think I know exactly what we need. We're going to storyboard this up, and there'll be no shooting. I'm going to do this all with prompts, and I'm going to prompt the crap out of this for the next 24 hours until that box gives me the images I want to see. Right? Okay. Well, what if the agency is all AI? What if the brief came from an AI, right? And that just generated what you needed. You could imagine that. Yeah. Then I don't know.
I don't think we're that far off from even having dynamic commercials. It's that what I'm going to experience might be different than what you experience. And therefore, the global effect that many of us appreciate about someone else's hand is what we call today pop culture, right? It's something in culture that we all share. And because of that, we can express, even if we all hate it, it's something that part of pop culture that we can meme the heck out of. That if the generative work of a computer can keep up with in the future that work, what will be the work of the artist? Here's what I know. There will be the work of an artist. We just might not understand what that position is any more than in 1982, they understood what was going to happen in 2002 of what it meant to do computer graphics.
That's why I tried to use the caveat that I don't know. I don't know, but you can take a shot at it. And if you go back to the analogs we've been talking about, if you worked in a photography studio and your boss, the photographer, was ranting about Photoshop, just ranting about it, you could be really confused about the future of photography and Photoshop, right? Because this man or woman that you looked up to just absolutely detests this piece of software, and it's going to ruin photography.
Mm-hmm. And Ansel Adams, I wouldn't want Ansel Adams to have Photoshop, but I don't know if I'd want, if he would make the prints today in competing, right? So we have to appreciate the work of the artist and the technology at the hand. From music, from antiquity to today, we can appreciate, looking backwards, the evolution of a musical instrument that will also take place in our generation. It's actually, I think, the fun part. Many of us think of transitions as something that we can't grasp. Therefore, it confuses us or scares us, or at least makes us double check questions, like Tyler Perry changing his investment strategy. Okay, there's probably some good cognitive understanding there of what's going on.
Right.
But what we're trying to approach with our industry is to say, how do we promote the individual and allow them to still be living in a career that they love? That feels to me like what Stash is about, like understanding the work of the people, giving them the credit, and then pushing that industry and that skill, that craft forward in front of other people.
Yeah, I would say that you understand it perfectly.
I want to ask you one more thing here, because the Epica article, you also talked about how Stash has seen or does the work of recognizing minority contributors. And I think it's so wonderful that you have such a worldwide voice and can give us concepts that if I stayed within my geographic region, I don't know if I'd have all that opportunity to see and appreciate the work of other artists in different countries or from different backgrounds. I don't have the exposure, but the work that you do at Stash puts that in front of me. Do you feel the burden of that? Do you feel the opportunity of that? What's that like to know that you're seeing something and you're curating something that creates such a large influence for people?
Well, I don't think we should blow it out of proportion. It's there is influence, and there is it has meaning, definitely. And you know, it makes its blip in pop culture. It's seriously. That's why we monitor so many sources. We answer every submission manually. We take it very, we try to be polite, you know, we try and be not on our high horse about it. It doesn't weigh down on me. I enjoy it so much that it doesn't feel heavy. It feels kind of joyous, right? Because you can share really cool work, which is something the only thing I ever really wanted to do. And you know it's having an effect. You know people are seeing it. You know it's influencing people and it's helping people. Like, you know that you can help a small studio who's ready for world-class. They're doing stuff, or it's not even, sometimes now it's just a guy, right? Or a woman, sometimes in Chinese, you don't know. The name is written in Chinese, you have no idea. It could be a woman, could be a man, he could be 16, he could be 75, you don't know. All you know is this 30-second clip is as good as anything else that you've seen in the last 3 months.
Yeah.
Right? And that's one person, and their buddy did the audio.
That's what you're doing, is you're flattening the earth for just good work to be seen.
There's definitely some of that, because the very biggest studios will be right beside the student work, will be right beside the passion project that, you know, the client abandoned it. And these guys said, screw that, we're finishing it anyway, right? Three guys in a basement in Slovakia, or a crew of literally 400 on a spot that the mill did, between three of their offices, right? They'll be right beside each other. And the cool thing is, it's really not about the budget. It's really not about the size of the client or the name of the director. It's about the emotional reaction you had to that spot.
Right. The creative production and emotional. That's what makes it relevant. That's why we attach to it. It can be a YouTube video. It could be a Super Bowl commercial. We still attach in those three ways, right? The creative ability, the production ability, and the emotional attachment are these universal qualities. I think that is your secret sauce. I mean, I think you said it earlier, and I think that's what we want you to do for us as an industry. Can Stash please keep doing that for us?
Very, very happy to. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, Stephen, if people want to subscribe, they're not yet subscribed, where would they be able to join you?
Just stashmedia.tv/subscribe, but you can just go to the site. Everything is very obvious there. And you can always just do a trial, you know, just do a free trial and see if it's for you. If, you know, if you have 17 digital subscriptions in your life already, you may not be ready for another one. But if you want something that is designed for you, I mean, it's a B2B streaming platform, right? It's the Netflix for motion designers. And there's 6,500 clips in there, right? Mm-hmm. It keeps growing. It just keeps growing every year. So we have a lot of partner events who we help. We're just media sponsors for them. So we help, you know, the in real life world, help make them connect people. Small, tiny events like motion meetups in the center of the UK with 40 or 50 people to off, which is, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, like, you know, tens of thousands anyway. So again, it's not about the size or the budget. It's about on that event front, if these people sound enthusiastic and they love what they're doing and they don't sound like dickheads, then we're going to help them. We're going to help them get the word out about that event. And the payoff for us, of course, is they see us at that event. And the more people that see us involved in the things they love, hopefully that leads to subscriptions, right? Because that's our business model.
Are you going to Barcelona this year? I was going to invite you. We have a cocktail hour. I wanted to make sure that if you make it there, that you know, really? To come join us at the cocktail hour. Yeah.
I have never been to Barcelona, so maybe. This was more fun than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be, you know, kind of uptight, but it's been great.
No, I'm so curious. And I truly, I remember talking to ProMax and just thinking, my gosh, you're like me. You love this stuff too. And we're both just fighting hard to make a living at it or whatever. And to see you thriving is just really great. So I'm glad that we reconnected and could do more together. It'd be kind of fun.
Cool.
But it's been a pleasure. Thanks again for taking your
time. Yeah, you too. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Rev Thinking Podcast. And thank you for being part of this journey where we dive deep into the heart of creativity and the business behind it. If today's conversation inspired you, sparked an idea, or gave you a tool to move forward, please share it with someone else who could benefit from it. Your support helps us reach and empower more creative entrepreneurs just like you. The Rev Thinking Podcast is a product of RevThink and hosted by myself, Tim Thompson, founder and chief revolution thinker at RevThink.
Don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date with our latest insights, stories, and conversations. And if you're looking to dive deeper into mastering the 7 ingredients of a creative business, visit us at revthink.com. Here you'll find resources, tools, and a community of like-minded business leaders like yourself. If you are a studio owner, join us at revthink.com/community and join our community of over 600 business owners learning, discussing, and sharing life together. At RevThink, we're here to help you thrive in your business, life, and career, because at RevThink, we believe the best way to deal with the future is to create it. So until next time, keep creating, keep innovating, and remember, your best work is yet to come. I want to tell you about a place to connect that you might not know about. It's our online community called Rev Community. It's a great place to get to know other creative business owners like yourself, to share some thought leadership and read other encouragement, to be challenged in this new marketplace, new technology, ideas, economic trends. And it's a place to research. Check out many of the resources we have online, our videos, and of course, this podcast. Join us today at revthink.com/community. If you're a creative studio owner, feel free to join us today at revthink.com/community. I look forward to seeing you there.